fifth case of the day, Gonzalez v. Mies.
Mr. Moore. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My client is being held in violation of the Sixth Amendment. He was denied effective assistance of counsel because his trial counsel, Jay Hershauer, had two actual conflicts of interest, both of which resulted in an adverse effect on his performance as his counsel.
What did he do that he wouldn't have done if there hadn't been no conflict, or what didn't he do that he would have done if there were no conflict?
The two things that the counsel did that he would not have done but for the conflict, one was counseling the co-defendant to take a deal, actually two deals, both of which envisioned trading information for leniency, and the second was not calling an exculpatory witness.
Hold on. I do not recall that it required trading information.
It envisioned that she would trade information for leniency.
If she did, not that she had to.
That she would receive leniency if she gave information. That's the second one with the cleanup statement.
Yes.
The first plea agreement, as the Indiana Court of Appeals found, envisioned it was a tacit requirement that she testify against Gonzalez. Describing the difference between the first and the second plea agreements. Say again?
Did she?
She did not, Your Honor. And under Kyler v. Sullivan, we don't have to demonstrate that she did. There's no requirement to show prejudice or harm, Your Honor.
Understand.
But it wasn't leniency. It was immunity for prior activity. It didn't have anything. The cleanup statement didn't have anything to do with what her sentence was going to be in this case.
By the time that the second plea agreement arose, it didn't change the sentence, Your Honor, but it did give her leniency in that it gave her immunity for her prior crimes. Anything that she admitted to from prior to December 29, 1997, she would receive immunity for those crimes if she gave a cleanup statement about those crimes.
Let me ask you this. What evidence is there in the record that Attorney Hershauer knew that Lapcheska and Gonzalez engaged in joint criminal activity prior to December 29, 1997?
Mr. Hershauer's own testimony at the post-conviction hearing was that if he had understood that this required her to testify against him, he never would have offered her the agreement.
But that's my point. Did he know? Is there anything in the record that shows that he knew that she would have to testify against him, or she would inculpate him in prior criminal activity?
Your Honor, I think at the post-conviction hearing he testified that he understood that their joint criminal history was intertwined together. They lived together. They were lovers. Her criminal activity was his criminal activity. And he testified that he would not have offered her the plea agreement if it had been his understanding that it would have required testimony against him, which implies that he understood that that testimony would have inculpated Mr. Gonzalez. Anyway, seek the remedy here under 28 U.S.C. 2254 D1 because the state court's conclusion that he did receive effective assistance of counsel was contrary to clearly established federal law in Kyler v. Sullivan. Turning to Ms. Lapcheska again, in February 1998, Jay Hershauer helped negotiate two plea agreements, both of which envisioned a trading of information for leniency. The first agreement was 15 years with the tacit requirement that she testify against Gonzalez. The Indiana Court of Appeals described the difference between the first and the second as an increased sentence but no requirement to testify. The second plea agreement, again, 20 years, no requirement to testify, but the written requirement in the plea agreement that she give the cleanup statement for any prior criminal activity. As soon as the state offered either of those plea agreements, Mr. Hershauer had a conflict of interest. He could not simultaneously advance the best interests of both clients. If he told Lapcheska to take the deal, he's acting contrary to the best interests of Gonzalez. He's telling a co-defendant to go to the police and give information in exchange for either immunity or a reduced sentence. If he had told her to not take the deal, he's acting contrary to the best interests of Ms. Lapcheska. She got a good deal from the prosecution. She's now out of jail while Mr. Gonzalez is still in jail. At that moment, Mr. Hershauer was a servant of two masters. He could not simultaneously advocate effectively on behalf of both of them at once. That's the moment when the conflict arose. At that point, there's no Sixth Amendment violation. If Mr. Hershauer had simply recognized that and stepped back and withdrawn representation of either defendant or both, there would be no Sixth Amendment concern here. Mr. Hershauer, however, told Lapcheska to take the deal, both of the deals, in fact. That's where the Sixth Amendment violation happened, because that's the moment where his, in the words of this court, where it's a reasonable likelihood that his performance would have been different. A reasonable likelihood that a non-conflicted attorney would not have told a co-defendant to go to the police and give them information, would not have told the co-defendant to take an agreement that gave her immunity in exchange for information about her past criminal activity with his client. This is contrary to Kyler v. Sullivan. One way that a state court decision can be contrary to clearly established federal law is if it applies the wrong legal standard. Kyler sets up a two-pronged test. Is there a conflict of interest, and was the performance of counsel adversely affected by the conflict. The state courts added a third prong. They went back and looked at this question of whether or not Gonzalez might have known about the joint representation. Supreme Court has said consistently in Holloway v. Arkansas, in Kyler, in Glasser, joint representation in and of itself is not a constitutional problem. The constitutional problem arises when the joint representation turns to a conflict of interest. In this case, the state courts, by going back and saying there's no ineffective assistance of counsel because we found that Mr. Gonzalez might have been on notice of the joint representation, has ignored the test that Kyler mandated for the court.
Let me ask you, are we proceeding under 2254A or D?
D1, Your Honor.
D1. Okay, thank you.
Turning then to Mr. Campbell. Mr. Hershauer made Larry Campbell an integral part of his defense of Mr. Gonzalez at trial. In no less than 12 places in the trial record, Mr. Campbell's name comes up.
Can I address a threshold question here? Why aren't the arguments regarding the conflict of interest as to Campbell procedurally defaulted? In the petition to transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court, the question presented for transfer was clearly limited to the issue of dual representation of the defendant and Lepcheska. Campbell wasn't mentioned.
Not in the question presented, but Campbell was mentioned in the petition. The Indiana Supreme Court was clearly on notice that Gonzalez contended that there were multiple conflicts of interest,
but
one with Lepcheska, one with Gonzalez.
Doesn't your answer to the question presented on transfer control here, then?
We'll concede that throughout the proceedings here, Your Honor, this question has been focused increasingly on Lepcheska throughout. We do believe that the petition for transfer mentioned both. We'll distinguish this, for example, from the Baird decision. In Baird, the petition for transfer never mentioned either the subsection C2 or the subsection C6 claims, and that was the grounds on which this court said that it had been defaulted. In this case, clearly, the petition for transfer mentions both Campbell and Gonzalez. And by way of further answer, Your Honor, even if we've defaulted the question of Campbell, the circumstances surrounding Campbell provide an increased understanding of the cavalier attitude with which Mr. Hershauer was dealing with conflicts in general, and it supports the argument with Lepcheska.
Counsel, could the could Campbell's testimony have been relevant to the possession charges? Which was all that was left, right?
That's not all that was left. His testimony would be relevant to the dealing charges. And again, if we were proceeding under Strickland, that would matter because it would be a question of what is left that the result of the trial would be different. The problem isn't whether or not Mr. Campbell could or could not have inculpated or not inculpated with respect to that charge. The point is that Mr. Hershauer had a conflict of interest. He could have called Mr. Campbell to the stand but for that conflict of interest to call into question the origin of the cocaine that was in evidence against Mr. Gonzalez. However, he couldn't because he was conflicted out of doing so. Now, of course, after the fact, 12 years after the fact.
Yeah, that's what I'm driving at.
Well, this time, again, Your Honor, if we had to prove prejudice, that would be fatal to this case as far as Campbell, because there would not be prejudice because that charge has been dropped out. At the time, however, that he made the decision, the question is whether or not whether he had effective assistance at the moment that he was representing Mr. Gonzalez. At that time, he had no way of knowing that 10 years down the road, one of the charges would drop out.
I see that
I'm into rebuttal. I will reserve the remainder of my time unless there are any questions.
Mr. Gleason.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court because the Indiana courts and the district court properly and reasonably found that there was no actual conflict of interest with regard to Mr. Hershauer's representation of Mr. Gonzalez.
Are they entitled to do that?
I'm sorry.
Are they entitled to do that when there's a obvious conflict on the record?
Was he entitled to represent both of them?
In spite of that fact that they can say there is no problem.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I'm not sure I put it appropriately. But can they decide that when it's on the surface of the thing, there's dual representation with a conflict? There's no doubt about the fact there's a conflict, is there?
Oh, there is doubt. There's a conflict. There are possible conflicts.
What I'm saying
here.
Okay. Possible conflict. Once you reach that point, can they take the next step and say, but there was no actual conflict because?
Yes.
And what is the because?
Because there was no. Because the interests of the two parties, Ms. Lepcheska and Mr. Gonzalez, were never at odds with one another.
Why not?
Because Ms. Lepcheska never had any intention, and Mr. Hirschau knew this, and Mr. Gonzalez had never no intention on turning on one another. Their defenses were not exclusive of one another. There was no risk of one of them testifying against the other.
He has the duty to counsel them for their best interest.
Yes, yes, he does have that duty.
He could counsel one of them to talk turn against the other.
If one of them had that inclination, there might actually have been.
I'm talking about not the inclination of the defendants, but the duty of the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Discuss their best interest with them.
Well,
counsel them to turn one against the other. Does that exist?
No, I don't believe so. I think the United States Supreme Court and this court has explained that of course, dual representation poses all sorts of possible problems.
Yeah,
and that would be a possible one, but until the situation arised where that was the attorney believed, at the very least, I would think, the attorney would have to believe that's the best course of action for one of the other defendants, and then he would have to get out. But Mr. Hirschau, there's no evidence that Mr. Hirschau ever believed that that was the case. In fact, he testified in detail that he was acutely aware, in this case and in several other cases, that he had potential conflicts of interest, and that's because there were only two major felony public defenders in this relatively small county in Indiana. And they, at this period of time, they had drug stings and drug busts that were resulting in, as in for this example, six people arrested. So one of them got three clients, the other one got the other three. And then there was another example he gave just, I believe, a couple weeks later where there were 10 people arrested, and he got some, and the other attorney took some. So they had to be very careful about this. They were acutely aware of it, and he even testified that if there was ever a circumstance where it became necessary, even if there was the offer by the prosecutor for one of them to flip on the other, that would have meant he had an actual conflict of interest, and he would have had to have withdrawn from both of their cases in light of the fact that he had potential information. But that never occurred. In fact, it was the policy of this prosecuting attorney to never do that. He never offered plea agreements for one to flip on the other because he felt that that was bad policy. Mr. Hirschau testified to that and said that he had never experienced that. So Mr. Gonzalez and Ms. Lepcheska's testimony at the post-conviction relief, in light of that information, which the trial judge, an experienced trial judge in that county, undoubtedly knew those facts as well, they're just inherently incredible. And that's ultimately a call on the credibility of witnesses that was made by the trial court in this case, affirmed by every court so far, and is entitled to the presumption of correctness, at least absent clear and convincing evidence. And there is no clear and convincing evidence. In fact, there's not even convincing evidence of any conflict of interest in the first place.
Let me ask you one quick question. Do you agree with Mr. Morris that our review in this case is under 2254 D1?
Well, that is certainly the way that they have framed it.
What do you think?
The district court actually said that Mr. Gonzalez in the district court never made a 2254 D1 argument. He only made a 2254 D2 argument, which is the unreasonable application of facts.
What's the government's position here?
That is really the only claim that he can press on appeal. But in any event, even if we were to look at an unreasonable application or contrary to, the state courts, on the face of the opinion, they didn't even need to, but they did discuss Kyler, they did apply Kyler, so it cannot be a contrary to case. The unreasonable application clause, whether it's the unreasonable application of Kyler or the unreasonable application of the facts in light of the evidence actually presented, there were judgment calls. There were credibility determinations. And there was no evidence of any actual conflict of interest, which is the only conflict of interest that Mr. Gonzalez can win on, if he could prove it. I phrased that a little indelicately, but in other words, that's the only claim that he can make. and he has no evidence to support that. That is particularly true in the Campbell situation, where he presented no evidence at all about Mr. Campbell. The only evidence was that from Mr. Hershauer that he did not represent them at the same time. In light of that, that's the only evidence, so there could be no conflict. I would also like to point out that the Indiana Court of Appeals specifically found that there was no requirement to testify at all in either plea offer. The only thing that was contemplated, of course, is the possibility of a cleanup statement, and that offer in there was merely that the state would forego charges, not really immunity. Under Indiana law, immunity can only be granted by a court, not a prosecutor, but a nulla prosequendum or whatnot.
On the other hand, when a prosecutor makes the motion, the court has only one way to handle it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I say when the prosecutor exercises that decision, the judge has to go along with it.
Well, actually, under Indiana law, he would not.
Under Indiana law, he can reject that and fire somebody else. Illinois, too, but not federal.
Right. And there's no suggestion, however, that that was ever even suggested. The prosecutor never went even after Ms. Lipcheska for not following through with the terms of her plea. So she clearly followed through with them. To the extent that there was any offer of leniency, it was merely that if you give a cleanup statement, we won't prosecute you for what you tell us. That makes sense with, of course, the way drug prosecutions go, which is very much vertical. They were looking for the people above Mr. Gonzalez in this chain, not Mr. Gonzalez themselves. They had him on tape. Dedrew's rights, there was no getting out of his conviction. Didn't need Ms. Lipcheska. They didn't seek her cooperation, and there's simply no conflict of interest in this case. However, we could dream up of all number of hypotheticals that would have presented an actual conflict, which, respectfully to Mr. Gonzalez, is all of his argument. We ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Your Honor, four short points. We understand that Mr. Hershauer claims that if there was ever a circumstance where a co-defendant might flip on another, he would never have taken that plea, apparently except for this case. The evidence shows that he did counsel Ms. Lipcheska to take that. We would caution the court that it's not an exception to the Sixth Amendment that just because there's only two defense attorneys in Cass County, Indiana,
I was unimpressed with that argument as well, but go ahead.
Your Honor, it's not an exception to the Sixth Amendment that there's only two public defenders there, Your Honor. We'd also caution that it's not an exception to the Sixth Amendment that we can say that because this prosecutor has a history of not taking this kind of a plea or taking this, or that somehow Mr. Hershauer's attempts to encourage Ms. Lipcheska to take this agreement can be excused. The conflict existed the moment that she was given the agreement. His performance was deficient the moment he told her to take it. The state also asked us to go down this road of questioning what might have happened and speculating about what might or might not have happened. A question about what information does Ms. Lipcheska have? Did they really need it given the fact that things were on tape? Kyler tells us that we don't go down that path. We don't engage, in Kyler's words, in the nice calculations of what the prejudice might have been. Kyler says that once we have the conflict of interest, and once the attorney has taken actions contrary to the best interests of his client because of the conflict of interest, we don't wonder whether or not the tape might have outweighed whatever testimony Lipcheska had, or whether the prosecutor might have chosen or not chosen to call her. For that reason, Your Honor, we ask that the court grant the petition.
Please will be taken under advisement. You were appointed, were you not, sir?
We were, Your Honor.
Deep thanks to this court for the excellent work you've done on behalf of your client.
Thank you.